Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg.
Hello, and welcome to the Songs of Note podcast. I am so glad that you're here today. One of my favorite things about this podcast has been like a story comes up or a song comes up, and I think, what's that song about? And actually getting to find out a really cool story about a song. Okay, so here's what happened. I'll give you in real time what happened. My family was going on a vacation to Colorado. We live in Texas. We were going to drive. Kids are in the back, loaded up. I'm backing out, and I say, you know what? We're going to need a vacation kickoff song, and that kickoff song is going to be AC/DC's Back in Black. You know the song. And the cool riff, which is difficult to play for guitar players, but it's a great riff. But full disclosure, AC/DC is a band where I know the hits, but I've never known the albums. I certainly didn't know anything about the story of the band. So we're jamming. The song is cranked, pulling out the driveway. Very domestic moment. Maybe minus the AC/DC. But we're rocking out. And as we're pulling out, I mean, we're literally just still in the driveway. And my wife goes, "What's the song about?" And I was like, "Oh, it's just a rock song. Just Back in Black. It sounds cool." And she's like, "Back in Black?" And then I'm like, "I don't know. You know, but why don't you look it up while I'm trying to find directions on where we're going?" So we're all still rocking out. And she starts reading. Oh, this is the album. This is from the song from the album Back in Black that was released after AC/DC's lead singer, Bon Scott, died. And I was like, what? I don't remember. Like, I remember there being a thing with AC/DC, but I could not remember for the life of me what happened with this band. So rock people who are hearing this, I'm sure I just like lost all my credibility with you. So I try to have a lot of music knowledge, and man, I failed on this one. I didn't remember that this even happened. And so if you're listening to this and you're probably like, "Hey, dummy, everybody knows this happened." And I wrote my buddies who are all into music, and they're like, "Hey, dummy, this happened." And so this is my bad. I missed this. I did not pay attention in guitar class for this one. But for those who don't know, AC/DC got huge, got really big, and continued to get bigger, known as a killer live band. It's never been a group that I've gotten into like deep albums on, but it's always like fun. I like the Back in Black. I like just some of the songs that are just like killer rock songs, right? Great guitars, huge vocals. So, but I never do this story. So Bon Scott was the lead singer for the first handful of albums by this band, and then he died, and the last album that he sang on was Highway to Hell, which you probably have heard that song, huge rock song. And so he dies within a year of that album coming out, right? So this band is like on the way up. They have this huge album out. The lead singer dies from a combination of some substances that we'll talk about in the interview. And then they replace him with Brian Johnson, the new singer. Like 5 weeks later, they release Back in Black. They announced the singer in April 1980. Back in Black is released on July 25th, 1980. And Bon Scott died in February. So, I mean, oh my gosh, I can't believe the timeline of this thing. Of lead singer dies, singer is replaced, and the AC/DC story from the band, depending on the interview, is that Bon Scott did not write any of these songs. And so the band story, like I said, depending on what interview you're listening to, is that these songs were written without the old lead singer, that they're all written fresh with this new singer who started with the band in April. They write one of the biggest rock albums of all time that is released in July. So you're talking a quick turnaround. And then they do not follow that up with any songs resembling the quality of rock songs that are on Back in Black, in my opinion. So anyway, that's how this all played out. And my mind was blown. I was like, what? This is a story. So it's a long drive to Colorado. And I was like, let's find the book. Let's find a book on what happened. So Jesse Fink he's an author. He wrote a book called Bond, The Lost Highway, The Untold Story of Bon Scott and AC/DC's Back in Black. I start the book, I write him. I'm like, you know, would you be willing to talk? And so I timed the entire thing to listen to the book, finish the book, right before we were able to talk. And so it was really a very fascinating read on a character that I really did not obviously know much about, but there's so much stuff on YouTube of live performances of the band with Bon and with the replacement singer Brian Johnson, but especially with Bon Scott as a lead man, that it was just really interesting. I love stepping into rock stories that I missed, that I hadn't heard of, and this is one for sure. So I'm excited to have the interview here. So this is me talking with Jesse Fink. He has a Facebook Bon Scott forum with, I think he said 14,000 people in it. I'll include a link in the show notes. But you can also get his book. I'll put a link to that. It's on Amazon. I listened to it on Audible. But fascinating story. I hope you enjoy it. This is my interview with Jesse Fink. Hey, Jesse, thank you so much for taking time to come on the podcast today.
No worries, mate. Good to be with you.
Man, I have to tell you, it's been really awesome reading your book. I just finished it this week, and I tried to line up our interview so that it would happen right as I finished the book, so all the info is fresh. I am embarrassed to admit, as a huge rock fan, that I didn't know this story, and I found it so compelling. So I guess my first question is for you, you know, what made you want to write a book on Bon Scott?
Well, I mean, I had written a book called The Youngs, The Brothers Who Built AC/DC for St. Martin's Press back in 2014. That sort of came out of, you know, like an epiphany I had one night about AC/DC and the effect music had on me. So I wanted to write a book about sort of the effect that AC/DC's music has on its millions of fans around the world. Why is AC/DC the biggest band in the world? There's got to be a reason. And it's because of the magic that they create with, you know, simple riffs and just fantastic rock songwriting. So that was a very different book. And The Youngs was quite a successful book for me. It was published in, you know, dozens of countries, and I hit on my hands, you know, for the first time in my career as a writer. Mm. And so, you know, Penguin, who was my publisher here in Australia, was interested in maybe doing something in a similar vein. And I said, well, you know, why not Bon Scott? For Australians, Bon Scott is like a sort of a folk hero. Mm. You know, he's up there with, you know, Ned Kelly and Sir Donald Bradman as a sort of a national hero, right? But his life was tragically cut short with his death in London in 1980. And there's a lot of mystery around how he died. There's mm-hmm. also a lot of mystery around the issue of whether his lyrics appear on the Back in Black album. But for most AC/DC biographers that whose books I'd read, they seem to kind of avoid those two questions, those two sort of fundamental questions, because they're really bloody difficult. Right? How do you put all the pieces together to, you know, solve these mysteries? I suggested to Penguin that we do a biography of Bon Scott. None had been written since about the early 90s. So it was a long time between bios of Bon. So, you know, it was due, well overdue. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to focus on Bon's time in America. So, you know, starting from the first concert in Texas through to the end of 79, his last American concert in Ohio. And then for me, that was kind of like the blank part of the Bon Scott story. Mm. It was his time on the road. And because I thought, well, you know, if he's dying in a car in London in February 1980, you know, there has to be a road to that point. You know, things must have happened to him. You know, this wasn't an accident in isolation. And so that's really what the title is about, The Last Highway. Obviously, it's an allusion to Highway to Hell, but it's about the road that Bon took in America, you know, to that car in London in 1980. So I wanted to focus on America, but then, you know, when I had finished the whole American part, I realized, holy shit, you know, there's a whole other thing, which is, you know, write about his death, solve his death, get into this question of whether his lyrics are on Back in Black, and that part of the book alone, you know, ended up taking like a year and a half to write.
Oh, wow.
There's the American part of the story, there's the lyric part of the story, and then there's the death part of the story. And the death part of the story just sort of overtook everything because it was such a mystery.
Well, and it read that way. Really, what there was a lot of it. It felt like investigative journalism on a lot of it. I want to get to that. Before we do, for people who, you know a couple AC/DC songs, to talk about his life, like what would you say is the thing that really stands out? What made Bond great for the people who maybe just know the Highway to Hell song? They just know a couple songs. Like, what do you, to you, like, what stands out about him as a performer and a writer?
Oh, I mean, on a number of levels, I think he was extraordinary. A brilliant writer, above all else. Read the lyrics of AC/DC songs from the Bond era. They're incredibly clever and funny. He's got a fantastic turn of phrase. He wrote from his life. And I think that's why those songs from that era kind of really resonate and really find, you know, millions of fans, unlike, you know, sort of the hesitate to describe them as awful. But, I mean, a lot of AC/DC songs from more recent times are really horrible.
Right.
You know, they're lyrically horrible.
Yes.
Whereas from the Bond era, they're really fun to listen to. They're clever. They make you laugh. You know, they punch you in the gut because, you know, like the songs on Power Age are about, you know, human experience. You know, about not having money, about sort of being out of a relationship or, you know, just normal things. So I think people connect to those songs in a very different way. And the other thing was, you know, Bond was an amazing singer, obviously. He had a fantastic range. He also was an extraordinary performer on stage, just the way that he moved around the stage. If you're just watching Bon Scott when Angus Young is playing his guitar, You just focus on Bond and the way he moves. He just is mesmerizing to watch. And then, you know, coupled with all that, he was an incredibly entertaining, fun man to his friends and to his girlfriends, and very popular. But he also had a dark side.
Mm.
And obviously the dark side is, you know, part of the story, and that was something that I needed to address. And, you know, I guess a lot of people get upset when you bring up these things about their heroes, but, you know, that's we're talking about a human being here. Everyone's got, you know, different sides to them.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Well, one part that I thought was interesting is near the end of his life, you talk about how a little bit like, was he in, maybe he was in a persona he couldn't get out of. Did he create a situation that he was trapped in? And you talk about how he called his friend in Texas and talked about wanting to get off, like stop drinking alcohol or get off drugs or get off the road, quit the band. It was a combination of those things, I think. Is that right? Where he came to a breaking point kind of?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously that road that he had taken, you know, that started in Texas in 77 and went through to the end of 79 was incredibly brutal on him. You know, he was drinking every night. He was, you know, dabbling in drugs. I think he had got tired of this persona that he'd created, you know, around the band. He wasn't close, really, to other members in the band. It wasn't like he was hanging out with them after gigs.
Yeah.
He was very much a kind of a lone wolf. And he had a life away from the band. And so, you know, the story that's told in this book is obviously very different to, you know, the anointed narratives that you hear about AC/DC in the, you know, the official documentaries and so on. It's a completely different story. And, you know, what's interesting is that, I wrote about, you know, Bond calling Roy Allen in Texas in 79. And when, you know, the book first came out, there was, you know, a lot of outcry about that. You know, how could you suggest that, you know, Bond was going to walk away from AC/DC or that he wanted to quit? You know, how dare you? Mm. And what's interesting is that since then, you know, I've come across interviews from Bond with French journalists from 1979, where he was talking about exactly the same thing. Huh. And there was an interview recently with a former band member of Fraternity, which was Bond's band before AC/DC, where the guy said, you know, he'd had enough. He wanted to quit, you know. It was the end of the road for him. He wanted to do different things with his life. So I think that's been confirmed, you know. But so this book has taken on a lot of myths about Bon Scott, and it's kind of painted a very different sort of picture of him. And for that, you know, a lot of people are up in arms about it.
Well, one of the things that seemed to cause a lot of questions, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like the company line, so to speak, was that, you know, he had too much alcohol, he choked on his own vomit and died in a car. But you addressed how heroin could have been involved, how he could have, I believe, snorted heroin, taken it in some way. Mm. But why was that such a, why wouldn't they just fess up to that? Like, why was that such a huge thing as far as, like, if he did take heroin and do the drinking that he did? I'm not saying, I'm not condoning drugs, but I'm just saying, was it a matter of, like, why wouldn't they have just said it was alcohol and drugs? And, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, even now when I'm writing about Bond, you know, possibly dying from snorting heroin, immediately, you know, the word that springs into a lot of people's minds is junkie, oh, right? Mm-hmm. I've never called Bond a junkie, but you read, you know, things on posts on social media saying, you know, Jesse Fink is calling Bond a junkie. I've never called Bond a junkie in my life.
Mm.
You know, he just like many other musicians that were living in London at that time, were using heroin.
Mm.
You know, and it's not like you know, Bond and heroin is something that's never been talked about before. And when I did the Youngs, you know, I spoke to Mark Evans, who was the bass player in AC/DC, and he said, you know, Bond almost got sacked in 1975 for taking heroin. So, you know, there's a history there.
Gotcha.
And then Michael Browning, who was the manager of AC/DC, did his own book and talked about it like a second incident. And, you know, the conclusion that I come to in the book is that, you know, it was third time unlucky for Bond.
Hmm. What about, so you told a story in the book, and I'm going to be flat out honest on my initial reaction to it. You told the story about Bond was doing a concert, and please correct me if I mess up the details, but he was doing a concert, and I think he had had either too much to drink or he had done something, he had some kind of substance, and he messed up the lines in one of the songs. And afterward, he came up to one of his friends, and I think he said that they're going to hurt me. And I could be saying that wrong. But my gut reaction was, oh my gosh, did the Young Brothers kill Bon Scott? And I know that's so stupid, but that's where I went. I was like, oh no, is that where this is going? And then I was like, that's so stupid. I can't even wrap my head around that. So I pulled back. Oh. But what were you alluding to on that story? What do you think, what happened there? I thought that was crazy.
Well, that was actually in Texas, I believe.
Yeah. That's where I'm calling you from. I remember. I was like, whoa.
Whereabouts are you in Texas?
I'm in Dallas. I think that was Austin or so, right?
It might have been in, where was it? It might have been in Lubbock or somewhere like that.
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly, but, you know, it was Roy Allen, you know, talking about a concert that he went to and that Bond came off stage and said this to him. But, you know, like Roy was unsure exactly what Bond meant by that. And he didn't want to, you know, put too much importance on it, but it was just how he remembered what Bond said. Mm. But, you know, a lot of people obviously reacted to that as well. You know, there was an inference that, you know, the band wanted to knock off Bond or, you know, hurt him in some way. I just think he was probably, you know, completely strung out with, you know, booze and drugs at that point. Mm. And so, you know, Part of what I did in the book was that, you know, I would basically follow Bond concert to concert, state to state, and what I eventually discovered was that, you know, the further that he went on his journey through America, the more, you know, alcohol and drugs took hold of his life. And there was one concert in, I think it was Rhode Island, where basically they couldn't continue because he was so smashed.
Mm. Well, okay, so let's talk some specifics here, because this is the part of the book that I couldn't believe. And I listened to it over and over, and I was looking up clips online about it and looking for like band interviews. All right, so I'm gonna read a couple of the quotes back, and then I want to talk about dates, because the whole idea on what could Bon Scott have written parts or a lot of the Back in Black album is fascinating to me. So the official band line, at least what I remember, is that they had initially, or I don't know if initially, because I don't know if their story changed, but I thought it was that he was not included because Bon Scott was not included as a writer because he was not listed on any of the songs. But in 1991, there's a quote from Angus Young who says Bon wrote a little of the stuff. And in 1998, Angus was asked if he ever thought about quitting. And his quote was, "The only time was when Bon died. We were in doubt about what to do, but we had songs that we had written and wanted to finish the songs. We thought it would be our tribute to Bon, and that album became Back in Black." Mm. So what's the Young's stance, I guess, on if he participated in writing the songs?
Well, their story changes all the time. This is the thing. So if you're looking at, their interviews that they've given over the years about Back in Black, their stories change all the time. There's got to be a truth there.
Right.
And if the story keeps on changing, then I would, have serious doubts whether, the official story is true. Now, remember, I talked to David Krebs, who was the manager of AC/DC at that time, from Highway to Hell and through to Back in Black, and For Those About to Rock, Lieber Krebs was AC/DC's management company. Now, if David Krebs says to me, "I believe, Bon wrote songs on Back in Black," that's coming from the horse's mouth.
Yeah.
David Krebs gets money for Back in Black. He was their manager at the time. So, I guess it was a detective exercise. It was like, me going through old interviews, sort of piecing all these things together, finding the discrepancies, but not actually, making a judgment call. What I'm doing is I'm going to the readers of the book and I'm saying, okay, look, here's what happened. You make up your own mind.
Right. Yes.
So I've not gone and called anyone a liar.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
But I will present, things that have been said and say, hey, that's a bit odd, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot odd. So when it comes down to, like, I wrote out the dates. I was like, let's look at the timeline here. Highway to Hell is released July 29th, 1979. Bon dies the following February, February 19th, 1980. Brian Johnson is announced as the new lead singer on April 1st, 1980, like 5.5 weeks later. One, that by itself stunned me, because you would think with a band that was that big, that was on the brink of humongous things, my thought would be, we probably need to go like road test this guy. We need to go like test it out. But it was flat out announced. So that's announced on April 1st. Back in Black comes out on July 25th, 1980. I mean, how does a band lose the key person in the band, bring on a new person, and then release one of the most popular albums of all time and write all these songs and record them in that amount of time? Like, that screams all kinds of like foul to me, as far as like if they did it all without help from other writings or
well, it
doesn't
other make
lyrics,
any right? it doesn't make any sense at all, right?
No.
So if you look back at Brian Johnson's songwriting career in his previous band Geordie, he hardly wrote any songs at all, and then all of a sudden it was like three songs or something, and then all of a sudden he gets catapulted into AC/DC and sort of right off the bat writes "You Shook Me All Night Long."
No way.
Seriously?
Yeah. And Back in Black, and it was like, no. You know,
That's some of the best sort of rock pop writing ever.
Ever.
Wow, Brian, you're amazing. You know? Wow.
Okay, so like let's pretend he did. Then what else did he do? What was the next back? Where was Back in Black 2? What was the follow up that was so killer? I feel like this was it. I mean, other songs. They had Thunderstruck and they had some other songs, but like,
well, exactly. So, you know, you look at Back in Black, which I regard as sort of, you know, AC/DC's probably fourth best record, right? It's definitely, yeah, it's most successful, but probably in terms of the songs, I would say fourth best. And then from that point on, it was all downhill. And so by 1985, which is, you know, it's only, 5 years later, you've got a piece of shit like Fly on the Wall, which is one of the worst albums of all time. No, seriously, it's like it's recorded underwater.
Oh, no.
Have you listened to it? It's just shocking. It's just shocking.
Ugh.
It's like it was recorded in the bathtub.
Oh, no.
You know, this is AC/DC. So you've gone from Back in Black to Fly on the Wall, you know, in the space of 5 years. That drop-off cannot really be explained other than that I think, Bond's songs or ideas for songs were somehow incorporated into Back in Black. And I certainly get a heavy, strong vibe for Bond from songs like, you know, You Shook Me All Night Long.
Yes.
Back in Black. You can just hear Bond singing them.
Totally.
You know? And so if you've listened to enough sort of Bond era AC/DC, you kind of just know, you know, Bond's tricks, his lyrical tricks, and it's just all over that album, right? I'm not saying that he wrote the entire thing, but I do think that there are traces of Bond on that record. And, you know, I think, you know, as I said to you earlier in the interview, you know, Bond wrote from his life.
Mm.
You know, so you look at songs like that are on albums like Power Age and Highway to Hell. He's writing about people that he knew. And so, you know, you've got a song like You Shook Me All Night Long, you know, with this, you know, American thighs. And
mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, Bond, I mean, Brian hadn't even been to America, you know. You know, the story about who he was writing about has sort of changed over time. And, you know, but I'm down in Miami, you know, researching this book, and I meet a woman that I'm convinced is American Thighs, who was one of Bond's girlfriends, right? And she tells me the backstory to, you know, that song, her relationship with Bond, and it all comes together perfectly.
Man.
You know? So there's no proof.
Yeah.
There's no proof at all. But all I'm doing is I'm presenting an argument and I'm saying to the readers, hey, this is pretty compelling, don't you think? You know, for a guy who was writing about his life and putting it in his songs, and then you've got, you know, a standout track like You Shook Me All Night Long on Back in Black, which sounds like Bond, which has the zip and the cadence of Bond.
Totally.
And you're trying to tell me that this all, you know, came from Brian Johnson. I just don't believe it at all. So there are people that I spoke to, you know, who knew Bond, you know, like Doug Thaler, who was, you know, AC/DC's booker, you know, for their American tours. You know, he booked all their American tours, and he was close to Bond. And he said, "There's absolutely no way in the world that isn't a Bond Scott song."
Hmm.
He just knows.
Man, do you think like, years from now, after the Youngs have passed away, do you think we're going to have like a cassette rollout and somebody's going to find a demo of Bon Scott, you know, singing some of these lines as like a melody idea? Like, do you think those are floating around, or if they were, do you think they would have been destroyed? This is just speculation at this point, but I just wonder about.
I have heard, you know, that there are tapes. There's certainly nothing on YouTube, so, you know, I can say this 100% for all your listeners. There is nothing on YouTube of Bon Scott singing anything from Back in Black, despite, you know, many videos pretending to be otherwise. Mm. It just hasn't come out. But, you know, you do hear, you know, anecdotes from you know, Australian musicians who might have heard demo tapes of Bon singing Back in Black songs and, yeah, you know, but there's no evidence. So well, it's not like I can put it in a book, you know.
Sure. You got to think that if it's out there, that maybe one day it'll get heard. Who knows? What's the, can you tell the chartreuse lines story, not lines, the chartreuse eyes line, the little story about that?
Yeah. So the girlfriend that, you know, Bon had in Miami, they were, you know, they were at the hotel in Miami, sort of, you know, lounging out by the pool, and he turns to her in the sun. He says, you know, you have chartreuse eyes. You know, what do you mean chartreuse? Oh, you know, green. You're like the alcohol. And she said that basically that line was used in the song, and it was modified for You Shook Me All Night Long on the album. And it became Sightless Eyes. Now, what the hell does Sightless Eyes mean?
What does that mean?
Is she blind? And you know, you read it and it's like, that just doesn't make any sense. That line jars with me. It's like, you know, it's not quite right. But, you know, chartreuse eyes, yeah, I get that. You know, that's Bond being poetic.
Mm.
But, you know, the way that, you know, Silver Smith, who was Bond's other girlfriend, the heroin user in London, she knew the Youngs quite well, and she described the songwriting process, and that was that, you know, Bond would come up with lyrics for songs, and then he would send them off to the Youngs, and the Youngs would sort of edit them down or dumb them down, and that was the process. So. Mm. I do strongly believe that, you know, Bond's notebooks, which have taken on mythical proportions now, came into the possession of someone, and my belief is that, you know, his lyrics are on there somewhere. And so, you've got a couple of interesting quotes from Angus that sort of have added some mystery to it.
Well, in if I remember, didn't you say that his lyrical notebook went missing like immediately, and that the Youngs had access to his house or his apartment at some point? That was not an uncommon thing for him to have, for them to have access, or that somebody went and cleaned it up, maybe, or wasn't that some?
Yeah. So the story goes that that, you know, after Bond's death, that people who were working for, I guess, the management company of AC/DC at that time had access to the apartment, and that they cleaned out the apartment, and things that were in that apartment were taken and were never returned to the family. Now, I believe Angus has said in an interview that, you know, things were returned to the Scott family. Like, for instance, at the time of Bond's death, he was in the studio with a French band called Trust. We were recording an album in London. And Bond was actually adapting a lot of their songs into English, like for an English language release.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been working on those songs. And after Bond's death, the lead singer of Trust tried to get that paperwork that Bon had been working on and could never recover it.
Mm.
So, you know, a lot of things went missing after his death, and that has never really been adequately explained, you know, where those things ended up. You know, like I said, that whole story of his death ended up taking, you know, 1.5 to 2 years just sort of putting that all together, because there's just so many contradictions in various testimonies around, you know, that final 24 hours.
Man, well, the thing that this, the smoking gun for me was like, I'm hearing all the evidence. I'm listening to the evidence and I'm deciding on what, you know, what I think happens. And then it's like near the very end, the smoking gun is that the Bon Scott family is still getting royalties off of Back in Black. Why would they pay out all this money unless, and I don't see it being done in a sense of homage. I mean, you're talking about a lot, like, I think millions of dollars, I'm guessing at this point, that money that's been paid out, unless he was a credited, an uncredited songwriter. I mean, that to me, that was a smoking gun of the family is getting paid royalties on the album that they're saying he didn't write.
Yeah, yeah, which
crazy.
Which comes from an article that was written by Vince Lovegrove. Vince Lovegrove was a bandmate of Bon Scott in a band called the Valentines. Vince Lovegrove died about 10 years ago in a car accident. But he wrote a number of stories about Bon, and he said that one of Bon's brothers had said that they received royalties for the Back in Black album. And as you say, it doesn't really kind of make any sense because in terms of their business reputation, in terms of, you know, their... track record. The Youngs aren't renowned for being a particularly altruistic sort of family, or generous.
Yeah.
I'm very good friends with a guy called Tony Corrente, who was the session drummer on their first album. You know, he was only ever paid $35 an hour for his sessions. He never made a dollar. Well, you know, he's running a pizza parlor in Sydney. And he's only been trying to, you know, meet Angus Young, you know, just to say hello, and he can't even do that. So, you know, the idea that, you know, an album that Bon had nothing to do with is earning quite a lot of money for the Bon Scott family just doesn't make sense to me. You know, if the story is true, as Vince reported it in his article, then, you know, that's very odd.
No kidding. I could believe that. Well, if you would, at the end of the book, I liked how you gave a couple different scenarios on what might have happened the night that he died. Would you mind summarizing on the version that you think was most likely, just kind of a high level of what you think actually went on that night rather than what people have said happened?
Well, you know, my feeling is that, Bon had some heroin, that he died suddenly, that the group of people that he was with, you know, panicked, didn't know what to do. They didn't want to get arrested for supplying, you know, the heroin that killed him. And they sort of hatched a plan to kind of leave his body for as long as possible before they took his body to the hospital. Hoping that whatever he had taken was not traceable or detectable in his body by the time that they actually took him to the hospital. So it goes against the, you know, the story that he died of alcohol poisoning, that he fell asleep in a car, and that he died sometime during the night that he was left in that car. It's a completely different story. So it was more of a... It's more a story of concealment rather than, you know, sort of accidentally discovering Bond's body.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people who were with Bond that night were either heroin dealers or heroin users, and he was certainly in the orbit of the whole heroin taking musician community of London at that time. And I find it very hard to believe that you know, Bond, who had already taken heroin, who had a problem with drugs, who his girlfriends, you know, told me that, you know, when he took drugs, he drank to excess, he, you know, became problematic, you know, that he was a bad drunk, he had a history of overdoses, you know, and he writes about that, you know, the song Overdoses about overdosing. I just think, you know, his luck ran out. But, you know, the conclusion they came to is that you can't really blame anyone else for, you know, Bond's death other than Bond. Because he chose to take those risks. You know, he chose to live that life. You know, he chose to put those drugs into his body. And he chose to hang out with those people. Mm. So, you know, and it's a complaint of mine that, you know, the Bond that you sort of see celebrated in things like Bondfest in Scotland and, you know, on television and in sort of, you know, the official documentaries and so on, it's like this sort of Peter Pan figure, you know, this rock and roll Danny Kaye. He's not that at all, you know. Bond could be quite a dark figure too. You know, he had a dark personality and, you know, there was a lot of light, there was a lot of humour, but there was also a lot of darkness. And so, you know, all I wanted to do was kind of just present, you know, the different sides to his character and do it in an honest way and, you know, just present him as a human being rather than this sort of cartoon figure that you see sort of celebrated you know, sort of annoying official documentaries and festivals and so on. Like Bondfest in Scotland, you know, to them I'm public enemy number one because I've written a book that sort of completely undermines the image of Bond the image of Bond that they want to preserve.
Yeah.
You know, that's fine. It's fine, you know, and I know that, you know, that I've done everything that I can do and the people that that I respect and that the new Bond have told me that I've done as good a job as I can. And, you know, I think there's also more to the Bond story. You know, mate, you know, I have been contemplating possibly doing a sequel in my lockdown reverie.
Yeah.
we're in our, you know, sort of, what is it, sixth week of lockdown here in Sydney. So, you know, I've been staring at Bond thinking, oh, is there more to this story?
Oh, interesting.
Because, you know, people love reading about it, you know. As I said to you, you know, we've got 13,000 people on Facebook, you know, in the Bond Scott Forum talking about Bond every day, you know. It's like, this is how many years later? It's like almost 42 years later, people still want to talk about Bond Scott every day. You know?
Yeah, that's saying something. There's a lot of interest there for sure.
Absolutely. And you know, when you think of, you know, other sort of rock figures that hold that fascination for people, there are very few.
Well, had he lived, what do you think would have been different for AC/DC? It sounds like you and I both think that AC/DC post Bond was nowhere near as good as when he was with them. What do you think the 80s would have looked like if he had lived to see them?
Well, I think I've said this before. I think he would have been a David Lee Roth kind of figure, and done California Girls or some sort of funny MTV video.
Yeah,
because he had that sort of that cheekiness and that larrikin streak and that kind of, you know, larger than life kind of David Lee Roth kind of personality.
Yeah.
And I think he would have had Jack of, I mean, I know that he had Jack of AC/DC. He had decided he, you know, kind of wanted to do something different with his life. But, you know, Bond was a guy who, you know, recreated himself all the time. So, you know, that character that he was in AC/DC wasn't, you know, the true Bond. He'd also been a hippie as well, you know. He'd been in a bubblegum pop band. So he was a bit of a chameleon. And I think, you know, the 80s was changing everything for everybody in the music business. And I don't think that, you know, Bond would have been immune from that. I think he would have had a solo album, done some sort of Starship-like kind of ballad. I'm joking. And probably decided, hey, I want to do something different. You know, he might have been an artist or something, you know. But then he probably would have returned to AC/DC, done a couple of reunion tours, milked it for all it's worth.
Made a lot of money.
And he'd be living in Florida right now, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Man. Well, Jesse, I really appreciate you coming on the show, being willing to talk about your book. I'm going to put a link to the book in the show notes and a link to the Facebook group, the Bond Scott Forum. a great pleasure. Really enjoyed your book and really enjoyed getting a chat with you tonight. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Ron. Cheers, mate.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.